Our presentation this morning is entitled, We're Here, Now What? And our presenter is Ponziano Aluma. Ponziano was born and raised in northern Uganda, Africa, and spent 6 years in a refugee camp in southern Sudan before being sponsored by the University of Regina Group for Refugees and World University Service of Canada to study at the University of Regina, from where Ponziano graduated with a Bachelor of Business Administration. Ponziano also obtained his Certified Management Accountant designation in 2009 and works for the Government of Canada. He is the father of teenage twins, Alia and Akia, and lives with his wife, Lydia, in Regina. Welcome, Ponziano.
Yeah, that was a good introduction, short and neat. I was telling Ellen and that I've been here, this place, three times. I don't remember the occasion for the first two, but I do remember the last one was summer 2013, when my daughter was right standing here. Yes, a high school student. She entered the writing contest, and she was published in that writing contest by the Writers Guild, a little magazine. I don't remember what the name is anyway. But anyway, so I was proud sitting here beaming because she had two of her poems published in that magazine. And after that, she rubbed it in. For me, really good, because I wrote my first book when I was 53, and she said she's published by the time she's 16. So I said, thank you, that's good. I thought I would start my presentation. I don't know how I can hide that part, because I really don't want... Pardon me? No, it's okay. Because there's a part there that I don't want to be seen, but I'm not as savvy with the computers as most of young... But hopefully we'll follow it anyway. My pastor, I always use this story to introduce this presentation. It's not my original story, but I borrowed from him because it captures for me what I normally want to say very well. He said there was a king who had a beautiful daughter, and he said he challenged the man in his kingdom, said, if any one of you wanted to come and marry my daughter, then you have to do this. And he sat on his sheet throne with his daughter, and between them and the other eligible man on the other side was a swimming pool, and in this swimming pool was a crocodile. And he challenged the man, whoever can swim across and gets to where we are sitting will actually marry my daughter. I'll give my daughter to them. And the man, of course, looked at this beautiful woman, and they really, really wish, you know, they will be the one to marry her. And then they look in the water, there's the crocodile. And nobody dared to jump in the water to swim across, even though they liked to marry that woman. And there was, another person who didn't like another man that really much at all. So while every man was thinking about what to do, somebody just, an enemy or whatever, pushed another man into the pool. And of course, once you're in the pool, you have to try to survive. So he was swimming, and running away actually from the crocodile. But of course he ran and swam across the pool, and he got to the other side where the king was sitting with his daughter, and everybody was clapping their hands and congratulating him because they thought he was so brave and made it. But all he turned around and said was, asked was, who pushed me? So I use this story to illustrate the situation, what brought me to write a book. And for me, it was a crisis. I did not plan and set about going to write a book, although the idea of writing a book had always been swirling in the back of my mind. But in my family, I experienced a crisis. My youngest sister, whom I raised myself, when I was here, they were in Uganda, she was raped by soldiers of Joseph Kony. Some of you might know about him, in northern Uganda. This was after my sister had already dropped out of school because she was suffering from mental illness. She dropped out of teacher training. And so while she was in that condition, she would disappear from the home. Nobody would know where she was. And in one of those disappearances is where this happened. And she was also infected by HIV. But then they found out she was pregnant with a baby. And so in Uganda, they get real good at doing this C-section so that the babies can actually be delivered safely. And so that's how, in 2008, my sister came to become a mother. And then 2 years later, the same scenario played itself. Another baby came around, and then my sister disappeared. And so I was the older, you will know, as an older, elder son in the family. I had 4 sisters, but I'm the guy. So then everybody looks to me to kind of step in and to do the right thing and take responsibility for these boys. So I started looking after these boys since they were born. And so when their mother disappeared, my parents are 70 and 80 years old. So they are too old to be concerning themselves about raising these children. Although, of course, some of you may be in this group called Grandmothers for Grandmothers. Africa is full of those kind of old people looking after young people. But my wife and I said, we're going to come in. We'll take the responsibility to adopt these boys. And then we found out we don't have the money to adopt them. It takes about $35,000 or even more to do it. And that's why the idea of writing a book came about, which was that, okay, we're going to write a book, and then we're going to sell these books, and we're going to use the proceeds of the book to fund the adoption of these boys. And it was this idea that actually set us to write a book. So it was really a crisis. It's like jumping through loops. And here are the two boys. And that's a Facebook page my wife and I have prepared. And it has kind of been quite a good way to capture. It's like they're stranded on the other side of the Atlantic, and we're here with our hands reaching out to try and reach them. So that's the story behind this. But then the next thing is, what are you going to write about? Not everybody's going to feel happy just, you know, buying a book just because you wrote a book. You have to have something to say that is going to make people want to read, and make people want something for their buck, you know. So then the idea that, you know, what about all these experiences of new people who have come here all the years, and they have actually struggled almost without a lot of people being aware of their struggles. And these struggles, they have a potential to provide a learning, you know, teachable moments for people. And also, how to help. There are people out here who want to help new people. And how to go about doing that with understanding. How do you make that connection? How do you kind of reach out? And so, why don't I put these stories together and then make it the book, it as a subject of the book? And that's what we decided to do. Now, this is, of course, my experience. He said that I was in refugee camp for 6 years. This will have been one moment when I crossed the border, crossing Uganda into Sudan. like this, running behind you, guns, you know, sounding, and you carry only what you can carry. And at a time like this, I remember among a people like this, I was carrying books in my head. Everybody was carrying food, and I remember having trouble with my father. But I loved books so much that that's all I carried. And in refugee camp, there was nothing else. In fact, later on, it turned out to be that, like you remember in my introduction there, because of a writing competition, I was given a scholarship to come to University of Regina here. And how that came about was there was an anthropologist from University of Oxford who came to our refugee camp, and she was doing anthropological study. And she just, to get ideas, said, you know, write stories of your experiences about anything. And so I wrote my heart out. And then my story won the first prize. And that's how I came to be known to this woman. And that's how I ended up being at Regina here, because how could anyone from this place jump, you know, from there to here? It was like a miracle. But that's my story. And I say, well, it's not just me. A lot of people like me make this trip, this jump. But when you come from that experience to a city like Regina, it's such a big jump. And a lot of people don't know really what you go through. It is such a big jump. It's like you who have been raised here, maybe everything to you is second nature, you know, familiar, but somebody who comes from that background to this, it's like you're going to a jungle. It's really into a jungle. And so I know that there are a lot of people who, when they make this jump, struggle. And those struggles often are not heard about. So I thought this would make a good, you know, a good material for writing a book. And so that's how we decided to do that. Now, for me, I decided, you know, after looking at this, I used the idea of the two icebergs. I said the refugee experience or the newcomer experience is really like a story of two icebergs in the same sea. You have people who come from maybe many third world countries these days, and they come here, their experience is just in the same proximity. They live their life in the same proximity like you guys, but they are also worlds apart. It's like two icebergs in the same sea. And everyone may see the top, maybe 10%, but there is another 90% of what makes that other person that you don't know. And they don't know much about you, other people here also, or the culture here. Because when you come from Africa, like I did, I thought I spoke English, I thought I understood Canada, we learned about the St. Lawrence Seaway, you know, we did about mechanized agriculture in the prairies, we knew all of that. So I felt like I know this place. And yet I didn't. Because when I got here, it was totally different. Totally different. So I only needed 10%, I knew 10%, maybe less, of what Canada was. And there's a lot I needed to discover. And when I came here, in the same way, a lot of people would look at me outside. They probably make judgments and conclude, I know who this person is, where they come from, what they will likely be like. But of course, they don't know much about me. So this really, for me, was the central idea about writing this book, is I know that there exists this reality about two icebergs in the same sea, in the same proximity. And so that will be. Now, how will this look like, this idea about two icebergs in the same proximity? In real life, what does that translate like? And so I got three different ideas. One of them is this traffic analogy. You know, all of you can relate to this. Rush hour, you're going home, and you've had a hard day. You won't get home. You have learned, you have done this thousand times. You know the traffic rules. Everybody's rushing. Imagine there's there among the traffic another person, a driver, who has never driven before. He had just been handed a key and said, get behind the wheel, here's the key. and drive. He has not learned what red light means. He has not learned what yellow light means. He has not learned what the arrows mean. He doesn't know much about traffic laws, but he is in the midst of the traffic. Can you imagine what kind of potential chaos this kind of person could face, you know, in that? And that is, in a way, what a newcomer's life is when you're thrown into this system, this culture. You come from that place where you know how to get along, I mean around, but then you come here, everybody knows how to get around except you. And you have to actually catch up, because the world is not going to stop and wait for you to catch up. You have to do what it takes to catch up. So that is, in a way, what a newcomer's life is like. The other example is, if I take any one of you, or somebody as a teenager, parachute them to the Amazon, let them go there, without nothing, no gadget, no GPS, and imagine how it will be for them to be able to find their way back to civilization. It will be very difficult. Everybody else in that forest who has been there for all generations knows exactly what to do. They know what fruit they should not eat, what fruit they should eat. They know the season. They can see. They read everything. They understand the environment. But you are going to be lost in that forest, because it's like you're taking a fish out of the river and thrown there. And that is the experience what it's like for new people when they come here. We have in Canada a very sophisticated society. You know, our culture, high tech, all that, we take it for granted. But new people, when they come, it is not always easy for them. It's very difficult. And often they come with a map in their head of what to do, how to navigate in the old places. And when they come here, that map is already outdated. But trust me, they still will try and use it. And what happens is, when you use an old map to try and navigate in this place, things are going to backfire. And it does happen a lot. And so that is an example of it. The other is, I'll give you my own example, my own personal example. Like I said, when I came to Canada, I thought I won a first prize in writing English. I thought I was good. I thought I understood and knew English. And in fact, I was teaching English, you know, to intermediate schools there. Now, yet, when I came here, I realized I didn't really know as much as I thought I did. I didn't know enough English to be able to get along smoothly in Canada. Now, for example, in Uganda, when somebody says, I won't take you for lunch, let's go for lunch, that means really they're offering to buy you lunch. You don't have to worry, even if you don't have a dime in your pocket. No problem, they're going to foot the bill. Now, you know, here in Canada, that's not necessarily the same understanding. It's like somebody invites you for coffee, invites you for lunch, you just maybe say, let's go and hang out. It's like almost, unless they explicitly says, I'm going to buy, you will actually have to assume that it's going to be Dutch, going Dutch. You bring your own money with you. And so, when I came in 1987 at school, at the university, a friend invited me to go for lunch. And of course, I had the map in my head. This guy's going to buy me lunch. And so, I didn't have any money. I didn't know that you had to prepare yourself, go with money. So we went. College West Cafeteria. It used to be where the bookstore is. If you've been to College West Cafeteria now, that's where the bookstore used to be. Where bookstore is now, there used to be the cafeteria. So this guy, I went with him. He picked a tray. And I picked a tray. You take one food from the line, put in his tray. I watched him. I did the same. I mimicked him every single way. And every one of these things you see in the picture, I know them individually. I know what donkey is. You know, in the Bible, They said Jesus came, entered Jerusalem riding a donkey. And that a word for donkey is an ass. I know that too. You know, so these things individual, I know them. And so, when we go to the till, my friend, who was in front of me, paid for his meal, and went ahead and sat at the table, got us a table. And I got to the table, at the till, and I didn't have any money. There I was, with no money in my pocket, food tray full of food. And in my mind I was going, he had invited me to come for lunch. And now I'm here and he's gone. And what am I going to do? And there was a lady, a big lady, who was the clerk, looked at me. And she knew I was new. And she understood. And thank God for people with a very sharp wit. You know, she understood. And she looked at this guy who was sitting there and getting ready and starting almost ready to eat. And she wagged her finger to him. Like this. Now I'm going to use a word here that I normally don't use. If I were to use it with my mother around, she's going to wash my mouth with sharp. But she said to this girl, bring your ass back here. And of course, I know ass means a donkey. So I'm looking. How is that? There's no donkey here. Why does she say, let him bring his ass back here? And then, of course, I go to look, what is he going to bring? What is he going to bring? And I was curious. I wanted to know what he's going to bring. So this guy came back. And then she just stretched her hand. Give me back your card. And the guy, you know, looked at me, looked at this guy, and she was immediately at the clerk. He was speechless. And he handed her his card. And she swiped it and got him to pay for my meal. Now, I was relieved, but of course, that was tension there. You know, you don't want somebody to be forced to buy your lunch. But here it was. Somebody forced this guy to buy my lunch, and now I'm going to sit next to him and eat lunch with him. How is that? You know, it was very hard. But I did. I went there. But in my mind, something else was brewing. I know that when he came and brought cards back to her, that paid for the meal. So in my mind, I made a connection. The ass must be the card. Because that's what he brought. Okay? And so I asked this guy, I said, after I had the courage, I said, can you tell me, please, how I can get an ass card? Now, these are for somebody who has been here, these mistakes will never occur to you. It will never occur to you that anybody will make this kind of mix-up. But for somebody who's new, who does not know where they come from, no bank cards, no credit cards, nothing. And of course, the slang, the Canadian slang, you can never learn in the textbooks in Africa. You can write a book, you can do whatever you do, but when you come here, the slangs will get you. Because you will never have known them while you are there. And yet, when you come here, because of that, there are holes in your map that you carry in your head. However important a thing you are, how well you think educated you are, the reality is that you can never be ready, fully ready, and fit the moment you come in this place on the first day. There's going to be a learning curve. And so, for me, that was my personal experience. Now, these things happen all the time to people who come to this place. And so I thought, you know, this is material I'm going to use to write my book. And so all of my stories in my book are basically that. I use humor. I use humor to illustrate incidences, comical, silly, humorous, sometimes near fatal, you know, experiences of people that when they first came here and they made these silly mistakes. Now, the feedback I've got is that people like the book because it allows them, in a way, to look at people's new experiences in with a different attitude. Instead of looking at people's mistakes with judgment, you know, it gives you an opportunity to look at them like as if, you know, children who have yet to learn. A child can make the mistake that we can always forgive them easily, but if the same mistake is made by an adult, we may not necessarily be that kind. For example, a kid will bring dandelions to their mother, say, "Mom, I love you, here's dandelion for you." The mom will brim, you know, happy. What if the husband came in with a dandelion and said, "Honey, I love you"? It will not be the same thing, right? But in a kid, we accept that. And so in my book, what I do is I take the newcomer, so to speak, dress them in a kid's costume and put them in that environment where what they do is going to be seen as innocence, something that they are learning. And once you have that perspective, then you don't exercise harsh judgment on the errors they make. But it also gives you an opportunity to get to know the person. It's, in other words, you have a chance to dive under the sea to explore the underneath of the iceberg with humor. That's what humor does for me. And that's why what I think has made the book very interesting. And so, people like it. We have been, the first time we did it, we printed only 700 copies. That's all I could afford, you know. And then we sold that all in 4 weeks. And then we printed another 1,400 copies, which we have sold all except 200. We have raised so far $20,000, including donations. About 14,000 of that is through the sale of these books. And if you are quick at numbers, you see that, you know, the numbers don't add up to explain the 14,000 because it should be more, but we are selling sometimes through chapters and bookstores. And when you sell through those guys, you have to pay them 45% of what you make. So that has kind of slowed us down, but it is better than the book sitting in my garage. So we have been making progress towards that. And so right now we are kind of still needing about 15, and we are right now at the point where we have to decide to print more of these books the same way and try to do the same thing we've been doing, or try and get it in a form of ebook where people can download it, whatever it happened to be. I have to figure out how to do that. I've been like a naive teenager who decided that, oh, I'm going to have a baby, and I have no idea what it means to have a baby. When the baby arrives, okay, what do I do? What do I do with diapers? How do I do that? You learn as you go, because I have no idea about the publishing industry. I have no idea how to go about doing the ebook thing, but that's what I'm considering now. Maybe that will be an answer to making that jump to the 15,000 that we are still going for. But that's where we are. And I thought that's what I'll share with you, but the idea I'd like to leave with you is, you know, pain and loss, where they come to all of us. And they come when we least expect it. But when they do, we actually sometimes get surprised. In some of us, it crushes us. In some of us, it actually brings forth energy and power that we never knew existed in us. because it makes us to actually reach deep into the depth of our resources to try and beat or fight whatever, you know, calamity that has struck us. I would have most likely never written a book if it hadn't been for the adversity that I found myself in. I'm not saying that this was good, the adversity happened, but I'm just saying that every adversity can be an opportunity to make a difference. And now for me to be able to use this experience or an opportunity to bring in the forefront the situation of newcomers, that is just an added bonus, because I found that a lot of people have responded positively to this effort. Since writing this book, I have been invited to speak to a lot of places. I went to North Battleford, to Meadow Lake. I spoke twice at the library. I was invited there. Last month, I was invited to speak at a university about how to write book in, you know, using humor. And so there have been a lot of doors that have opened, but I also realized there's a lot of thirst out there for people who really, really want to know how they can make a difference in the lives of their neighbors who are new. This idea of two icebergs in the sea, in the proximity, is true. It could be your neighbor, just next door neighbor. You know, outwardly they look like nothing is wrong, that there's no struggle in their life, but there could be a whole world apart from you. And so a book like this, I found, does put a bridge, you know, between people, that once you read about it, then it's easier to reach out to the other person who may not necessarily be, you know, a member of your family. And so it has really received a good response that way. And that's what I thought I would share with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ponziano. Very creative use of analogy. I'm sure some of the people here will have some comments or questions for you. And I will bring them in.
Thank you for this presentation. It certainly has given us something to think about in terms of how you have to dig in and you need to raise the money and how a crisis in your life brought something really good into other people's lives too, because I think a lot of people probably are benefiting from the message of your book. Mm-hmm. Right off the bat, I was wondering something. I've lived in three other countries, and I noticed pretty quickly that humor was one of the things that really didn't cross boundaries. Like, you joke about something, but the people you were speaking to didn't catch on, or they would say something to tease you or something, and it felt not so good. So how did you dare to choose humor? Or did you see a lot of parallels there?
Well, you know, I had a grandfather who, I don't know, had a certain knack of making people feel comfortable in situations where people would normally feel very uncomfortable. For example, each one of us here, you're sitting there. If I use the example, don't worry, please, don't be annoyed. If she were to fart loud next to you, your reaction is going to be negative. How dare you? People don't do that. It's a natural function, but people are ashamed to be found to be doing it, especially in public. Now, my grandfather somehow has gotten over that, in the sense that he could have a conversation with you and he could be doing it. And somehow he doesn't get embarrassed about it. And the reason is, if I can breathe, you don't have problems with me breathing. That's a normal body function. That the same farting is the same thing, normal body function. And in a kid, when a kid farts, we don't make any deal out of it. But as we grow up, somehow we get embarrassed about it. And so I hang around my grandfather many times. So I think I had a little bit of insight into what he discovered. That humor, and the way he did that was humor. He would actually laugh about it. Say, "Didn't you do that yourself? Why are you kind of worried about me doing it? You do it too, right?" And so he makes it light. And so when, as a kid growing around, and that happened, you say, "Oops," but you go about your life, right? You don't really stop. Your life doesn't stop because of it. And I think I had that insight from him. And you will also notice that in reality, most sensitive conversations, you can actually make it with humor. You know? Yeah, humor is like that. Really good. Yeah.
Hi, my name's Ingrid, and I've taught immigrants and refugees for many years at SIAST, and with the, well, they called it the ESL program, but I wondered if you've had a chance to go to SIAST to speak. And the other place, of course, is Open Door, where they have, you know, because I think it could be a book that could be discussed in the classroom, and stories could be shared, because I would encourage my students to. I found it very enriching to teach people from all different backgrounds and to hear the stories and for them to understand each other, to get beyond the top level. So, and then the other thing I just wanted to ask, I'm just wondering why 35,000? Like, I'm just wondering, like, you know, you've got airfares, and who's charging you a whole bunch of money to adopt, or is it the Canadian government?
I have presented on my website, on a Facebook page, we kind of have a breakdown of where all the money is going to go. Initially, we estimated 35,000, and at that time, I looked at the expenses. It starts right here in Saskatchewan. Before, even though these are my nephews, social services is jurisdiction over adoptions in the province. And they have to send a social worker to come and inspect my house and do a home study to say I am qualified to adopt my nephews. And of course, I have to pay that person $2,000 to do that. Okay, and it is, there's no way of getting around that. And then the other part is, in Uganda, we have to also do another home study. And the purpose of that home study is because they want to be able to prove beyond doubt that these boys are available for adoption, that there's no child trafficking involved here. And to be fair, they, on the nursing side, there have been disappointing incidences of child being trafficked. So Canada is very particular about that. So I have to pay another money there to do the home study. And then I have, Canada also has this rule in Uganda, they will not recognize any adoption order that comes from the lower courts because of the same situation where they don't trust the lower courts. So I have to get my adoption order granted by the High Court in Uganda. Of course, the higher you go with the court, the more expensive the lawyers get. And so I have to pay for that. And then my wife and I have to travel to Uganda. The law in Uganda requires the adoptive parents to be physically present in court when the adoption order is granted. And we're hoping that we can do that once, and we don't have to go back again. And then, of course, Canada doesn't have an embassy in Uganda. Canada's embassy is in Nairobi, Kenya. So we have to, the court is in Uganda, the embassy is in Kenya, so there's going to be going back and forth. And so, but $35,000 for two adoptions is actually cheap. You know, if you go to Canada Adopt's website, this will be only for one child almost. But the reason is because it's family. The expenses of fostering these kids, like my family is chipping in, they're living with my family. So that brings down the expenses. Yeah. Now, about your earlier point about the book, for your information, there is a group of teachers, including Pentas, and some ESL teachers at university. They're working on ESL version of this book. So because right now the language in this book is a little bit high, so they want to bring it down, and they will produce one for ESL presentations. Yeah.
Again, Ponziano, thank you very much for that presentation. Now, I sort of thought as you were talking, maybe as people come to the country, they should be given a button for their jackets that says something like, "Hi, I'm new, learning about you."
There you go.
Just to sensitize people that this is somebody that's new and doesn't know a lot, and maybe you have to be sensitive when you approach them.
Exactly.
Something like that may be considered. And maybe you can get a commission. Who knows for you?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.